And what was the first tree that you saw today? I've got a memory, I think, vaguely of mine. Did you truly take it in? Maybe offer it a small vote of thanks for the air that you breathe, or maybe not. Do you have favourite trees? Trees that perhaps strike you with a sense of their beauty or comfort or even awe? Jonathan Drury, I think, may have some that fit into these categories. He's a plant science expert and the author of a wonderful book, Around the World in 80 Trees. It's his first, and it's sumptuously illustrated by Lucille Clerk, his partner in crime here. And he joins us by weird coincidence. Jonathan, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
There are a lot of trees in the world, Jonathan, and you've whittled this down, as it were. Unfortunate choice of words.
Very good.
To 80. What was your culling process?
Well, I think I had two criteria. The first was that they should be all over the world, and the second that they should be interesting stories. And ones I hope that had a bit of science and a bit of history and a bit of folklore and a bit of how those things are all intertwined. So I think those were my criteria.
Did you come to this as a fan of trees?
You know, I did. I remember when I was about 5 or 6 years old, I was walking with my parents in a local park southwest of London. Hmm. And there was this fantastic cedar of Lebanon, which had been struck by lightning. And very sadly, it had died and was being chopped up. And it was the first time that I saw my dad cry. And up until then, I'd thought, you know, here was a man who was in benevolent control of everything. And I realized that he wasn't. Gosh. And there was something about the just seeing this tree. And I think ever since that moment, I've felt that trees are very, very important.
Because a grand old tree, I mean, you know, there's a thing which has spanned generations, many of them. There is something that there is a respect that's required there.
Yeah, and of course, you know, unlike animals, they can't up sticks and run away. See what I did there?
Yeah.
They can't up sticks and run away when they're under attack. You know, so they've had to develop all sorts of ways of defending themselves. They have one generation for thousands and thousands of generations of the things that would eat them.
Mm. And I mean, we're becoming increasingly fascinated by those processes and the secret languages of forests and the ways in which groups of trees can communicate with each other and the ways in which trees themselves relate to the world.
It is extraordinary how trees do manage to communicate with each other. They send signals. If a leaf is crushed by a herbivore or an insect, it starts making defense chemicals, and those defense chemicals waft around on the breeze and encourage other trees nearby to make those same defense chemicals. And some of those signals can actually travel underground through networks of fungi that sort of live symbiotically, in partnership with the trees.
We tread rather ignorantly in this world, don't we, with so much going on around us.
But, you know, I love the idea that there are things that are hidden from us and you only have to look and there they are. I think that's a rather wonderful thing.
We neglectfully didn't do this to begin. We've been sitting here for several minutes now talking about trees without actually getting to grips with that idea. What makes a tree a tree?
What's the definition of a tree?
Yeah.
Do you know, I've asked lots of scientists this and lots of botanists, and basically, you know, a tree is a thing that looks like a tree. I'm sorry that there isn't something more scientific than that. It's a big woody stem with a bit on top. And, if that's what you thought was a sort of child's explanation and how could scientists ever have something like that, it is basically that.
Okay. Tree is what you think it is. Fair enough.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
And there are about 60,000 different species, and you've managed to put 80 of them into your book. I wonder if there's a favourite in there, or you're not allowed to do that.
It's like asking which is your
favourite
child, isn't it?
Yes.
And it is true there are 60,000 or so species of trees, which means that I've got a few more volumes to do yet. I'd say that one of my favourites is the lacquer tree from China and Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you imagine a world before plastic, just to think about what people would have felt about objects that had been painted with these fantastic layers of lacquer and were waterproof and beautiful years before plastic was invented, centuries before plastic was invented.
Yes.
But one of the things I love about the, and that's obviously made out of the sap of this tree that's painted on in layers, onto wood beneath.
There's a dark side one of the to things, that, of course.
Yeah, there is. Yeah, exactly. There is a very dark side to it, which is that this sect of northern Japanese monks used to drink the sap of this tree, made into something called urushi tea. And they would gradually become more and more emaciated. And when they died, their bodies were kind of plasticized. They were mummified while they were still alive, really. And they were so sort of poisonous, their bodies, that they wouldn't decompose. Maggots wouldn't live in them. So after 3 years, when they were dug up, if they hadn't decomposed, then that was seen as a path to Buddhahood and enlightenment.
Yeah, well, that is a tricky path to enlightenment. I'm not sure how popular that might be in the current sort of generation of self-help.
You know, in Japan now, you can go to shrines and see these mummified bodies. This died out in about, you know, the end of the 19th century. But they put dark glasses on them, which looks really macabre.
When you approach a particularly magnificent tree, what are the thoughts that go through your head?
I mean, a whole lot of thoughts, really, because, you know, there are thoughts that go through my head, and then I always wonder what other people are thinking, because I think that a lot of people have a sort of blind spot for trees because they don't seem to move very fast, and, you know, you notice them when they're gone rather than when they're there. Mm. But I see, you know, something that's been there for generations, that if you could do a time-lapse photograph of, you know, a time-lapse film over decades, you'd see extraordinary movement and so on. And, you know, without getting too sort of hippy-dippy about it, you know, each tree has a kind of character and a history to it, and I love that.
I mean, it's interesting that your book starts with that London plane tree, so there's a real exercise in sort of recognition in the environment, you know, they are an interesting tree, even though they're sort of so ubiquitous.
Yeah, I mean, the London planes look really, really good after about 150 years. And the Victorians, you know, who were not without their faults, but one of the things they did do was really plan ahead. And those wonderful London squares with their huge, huge plane trees, you know, 100, 150, 200 years on, you know, someone had to be thinking all the way down the line to think, what's that going to look like? Is it going to show off the architecture of those squares really well? This is a wonderful lofty branches with where you're able to look across the square at head height, unobscured,
yes.
But you can see the buildings really well. You know, that takes some planning.
I wonder if our attitude to them has shifted. I mean, I get that same sense. I mean, Melbourne is a much more recent city than London, and yet in the 19th century here, people were planting avenues of elms, avenues of plane trees, with that same sort of sense of the longevity of these things. I mean, I wonder if our attitude has shifted, that we just can't quite get our head around that anymore.
Yeah, or maybe we've been educated to want a sort of quick return on everything. You know, so I think that, you know, I think people start valuing trees more when they have children of their own and they start thinking about future generations. I think the two go together.
Now, here's a little mind exercise for you, Jonathan. You have a magical patch in your backyard. You can plant just one tree. What will it be?
Well, now, okay, so trees obviously need the right habitats, and you haven't told me where the
cheating
backyard is. But okay, so I'm going to ignore
this. This is
that
a magical patch,
okay, yeah,
which is a universal habitat.
Okay, so here's the thing. One of the trees I really love is the quiver tree from Namibia. And it's a relative of the aloe vera that you use for cosmetics. Mm. And it grows in the desert, and it's completely resilient, and everything else is dead, but it is thriving. But the reason I love it is because it's the national tree of Namibia. Everyone smiles when they see it. It's like driving a Morris Minor. Everyone is smiling at you. And the second thing I love about it is because it's got this coating of a sort of white powder that has evolved actually to deflect ultraviolet light, but people immediately want to touch it. And so the idea of someone smiling at you and stroking you, just, I think that would be my tree that I'd want to be and would want to have in my magic patch.
That's a glorious thing. I mean, trees are having, as much as we revere and respect particular trees, there's a lot of trees which are doing it tough, and a lot of forest which is constantly being cleared. I mean, there are football fields every second that we speak that are being denuded.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, this is part of the what's called the tragedy of the commons. You know, when there isn't regulation over natural resources, people keep taking and taking and taking. There are some countries that are better at managing this than others. I have to say that my country, the UK, is not particularly good at this. And we lecture countries like Brazil and tell them not to lose their rainforests when we're losing forests of our own, which seems hypocritical. There are other countries in Scandinavia, for example, who manage their forests very well. But it often takes a bit of regulation and government intervention, and that's not always what people want.
Perhaps, you know, in work like yours, in a book like this, in that sort of sense of appreciation, I mean, maybe that's a beginning to shift that attitude.
Yeah, I mean, I tried to create 80 biographies, I suppose, they're sort of, you know, someone wrote very kindly in a review that this was a love letter to trees, and I suppose, you know, my approach was to try and fire people up with the sort of really interesting and unusual and bizarre antics of trees, the things they get up to and the things that people get up to, and then slide in a bit of science in a way that isn't too difficult and doesn't put people off.
Do you have an open fire at your place?
I'm just suddenly thinking, God, did I leave it on? Did I leave it lit? Look, you know, it's fine to burn wood if it's from a sustainable source, because I know that's where you're heading. I do have an open fire and got a place in the West Country in the southwest of England, and but it's all sustainable, and it's all stuff that's dropped off things that are living very happy lives.
Which is interesting. I mean, there's a mirroring here of our relationship perhaps with animals and the eating of animals, the consuming of trees. It's a similar...
Yeah, I mean, the trouble with consuming animals...
they have the sentience and all that stuff, you know.
Well, there's that side of it as well, you know. But even without that, the trouble with eating animals is that animals take an enormous amount of land compared with, you know, vegetables and vegetable crops and so on in order to provide the calories. So, you know, if we want to feed lots and lots and lots of people, it's difficult, you know, if everyone wanted to eat meat. So we should all be a bit more like Indians and have a more vegetarian diet, probably.
Well, you can't see the cows for the trees. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Jonathan Drury, now he has a wonderful book, Around the World in 80 Trees. You seek that out. He's an ambassador to the World Wildlife Foundation and the Woodland Trust, and author of Around the World in 80 Trees. Blueprint here on RN.